2 years into the Arab Spring transformation around the Middle East, life is beginning to change for citizens of the nations who are living a new democratic reality or still struggling with what democracy will actually mean for their people. The BBC's Hugh Sykes is our tour guide for a region settling into a more subtle set of changes and implications of new governments and new politics and negotiating some hairpin turns along the road to full reform. In a months-long tour from the Middle East and across North Africa, Sykes has noticed both what has changed forever and what remains ahead for the nations of this tumultuous region. He begins in Tunisia.
Tunisia is probably the least different, but the most surprising in the way that it's emerged from the Arab Spring. But they've all got one thing in common, and that is everybody is talking openly about the changes that have been taking place and about whether they like them or not.
And whether you're a tourist or you're a reporter, if you're in a place like Tunisia, and we'll hear it in this bit of your reporting, the politics is very much out on the street, and you can hear the voices and the debates as they're being played out in the country itself. Listen.
A spokesman for the new secular Call of Tunisia Nida Tunis party, Mohsen Marzouk, believes the West was wrong to characterize the ruling Islamist party, Ennahda, as moderate.
It was a mistake. I think people were quite, in a hurry to give such conclusion. The majority in Ennahda still Salafist, still radical. We are not against religion. We are against using religion in political life. And this creating a situation of high tension.
So what does that high tension mean? Do people believe that the sort of openness and kind of magical qualities of Tunisia will eventually be eroded by a political system that has an agenda?
There are people who are worried about that, but that spokesman for Nida Tunis has his own axe to grind. He wants to bring down the governing party, and of course he exaggerates the Salafist tendency in Ennahda, which is the ruling party. There is a Salafist tendency in Ennahda, but the people who I know in that party say it's a minority and there's no way it's going to gain power. The only way the Salafists are actually making a real impression in Tunisia at the moment is in a very sinister fashion. They're attacking completely innocent, harmless, peaceful, beautiful Sufi shrines, one very near where I was the other day. They just chucked an old motor car tire in covered with petrol and set it alight and wrecked the inside of the building.
Those are relatively rare occurrences in Tunisia, but I gather in Libya the sense of tension and the battle continues.
Yes, it was very strange. I found Tunisia really tense. There were riot police on the street, there were demonstrations and counter-demonstrations, there were these Salafist attacks. There was a sense of imminent unpleasantness. And the streets, very unusually for Tunisia, for Tunis in particular, beautiful weather, by about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening, the city centre totally deserted. I asked somebody why, and they said, because we're afraid. We're afraid of political violence. We're afraid of crime. We're afraid of instability. We're afraid of unpredictability.
Well, there may be this sense of fear after hours in Tunisia, but in broad daylight, the fight goes on, even amidst a certain amount of optimism in Libya, where you also visited. Listen.
In a market near Freedom Gate, I meet Mohammed bin Ahmed selling clothes from a cart.
How is life here now?
Ça améliore de mieux en mieux.
It's getting better and better, he says. Above all,
l'essentiel, c'est mieux que le criminel.
It's better than it was with the criminal.
Le colonel.
Colonel Gaddafi, of course, there. Is it getting better and better? Is that hyperbole?
Well, you know, I find it really strange. As I said, Tunisia was tense, and I suddenly arrived in Libya expecting to be really wary and full of anxiety about militia violence and everything. I got there and I sensed an atmosphere of extraordinary calm. I walked out of my hotel in the old Medina, the old city centre of Tripoli, and I walked down to the port and I wandered about and chatted to fishermen and joked around with children, and a huge weight of anxiety lifted. I thought, well, something here is going right. People are out on the streets, people look confident, businesses are open, cafes are open. And I went to see the spokesman, military chief of staff, the next day and said, be realistic with me. Tell me, am I right? Things are really going quite well here. Or is there also the dark side? There are still militia, extremely active, Islamist at one extreme, supporters of Colonel Gaddafi at the other. He said, yes, of course that's so. We are in a revolutionary or post-revolutionary situation. Revolutionaries submit themselves to military discipline. However, we are overcoming this slowly and incorporating as many as we can into the army.
So let's move to Egypt. You sort of said at the outset that Egypt has always been a place, a sort of tourist destination as well, even amidst political dictatorship. What's the sense there of change?
One change is in the tourism. My lovely boutique hotel, should I admit that on the radio, but extremely cheap. It's about $60 a night in the city center in Cairo. Quite often this year, I've been the only guest, or the only other guests have been other journalists. But Egypt itself, the politics, of course, they were liberated from the dictator on the memorable evening of February the 11th, 2011. I was there. I was lucky. I was there the night he went and experienced the joy of the crowds. But even that evening, some people came up to me and said, be careful, we've been tricked before. We're not sure that this really is our liberation. And others said, watch the Islamists. They're going to move in now. The Muslim Brotherhood is the best organized organization in this country apart from the Egyptian army. Well, that proved to be true, and Egypt now has a Muslim Brotherhood president, although to become president he had to resign his membership of the Brotherhood, but he's still of that ilk.
And you get a feel for what a Muslim Brotherhood-run Egypt is like. Listen.
Soon after the start of the revolution, Dr. Abdulaziz Hegazi, former Egyptian prime minister in the 70s before Mubarak, advised the Tahrir Square protesters, he calls them the boys, to get organized.
The boys never expected that they would succeed. They said bread, social justice. But the problem is that the Muslim Brotherhood came in, and so the boys were out.
So is the takeaway here all of these places have an open political discourse and all are grappling with some very complicated, in many ways, religious issues about governance?
Yes, I think that's absolutely fair. Again, I think, you know, if Egypt is a model, and in a way, even though Tunisia was the first of these Arab Spring countries, Egypt was the most dramatic when Mubarak fell. The lesson there, I think, is part one of democracy might not go so well, but part two, many people in Egypt say there will be a part two when people realize actually it was a mistake to vote for quite so many Islamists. Let's look for more secular people. And in 5 years from now, I think the scene in Egypt and possibly in other parts of the Arab Spring too will be very, very different.
All right, Hugh Sykes, reporting from possibly Act Two of the Arab Spring on its way to possibly more hopeful Act Three. The BBC's Hugh Sykes reporting to us on a tour of North Africa. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.